Good afternoon. You'll turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. That's where we will take a great deal of our lesson from today. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, you don't necessarily have to turn here, but Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 11, it says, "The words of the wise man are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd." Ecclesiastes is a book of goads and of nails. Words of the wise designed to goad or to prod us along, given by a wise preacher, meant to nail us or anchor us to some stability in our beliefs. I very much appreciate this. I was telling somebody here recently, I have a series of classes that I teach to the high school kids in Lee Summit over in Smart Road. One of them is Ecclesiastes, and I've made two or three rounds now with this series, if you will, and we're back on Ecclesiastes, and the poor kids, they had to listen to me give this lesson essentially on top of everything they've had to listen recently today. And so, at any rate, the point I tried to share earlier was I was amazed. The Lord's way that He gives us His truth to not only for us to repeat between and amongst, but actually with which to, shall we say, re-educate ourselves is a rather amazing thing. I thought that the book of Ecclesiastes was, you know, something that the value for me at my age is something to be basically already gleaned. An older preacher, father, Solomon to his younger son, all these wise things he had learned and the things that he should gather from, you know, take my word for it, this is better for you than the other. What I really appreciated about this time, perhaps it's about where I'm at in my life these days, is that's all well and good, but what I really appreciated was the way Solomon, the preacher, came back around in the midst of all that he dealt with, how he came back around to actually apply the concepts that he had to himself, how he had gotten to this place. For instance, we're talking so much, time and again did he say in the first six chapters that everything done under the sun, everything done under the sun, the meaning of life that he's pursuing, and everything that he found done under the sun was vanity and striving after the wind. Time and time again, he said this. Now, if we were to stop there, like so many others have, and so many others do, we might conclude that there's nothing worth living for. I mean, hide the sharp objects, right? In the final day, what's really being spoken of here is, if, in fact, we're under the sun, everything that we do in this life is what it appears to be, there's nothing worth living for. But, thankfully, Solomon doesn't stop there, and he quickly folds back in the dimension that's always missing, and that's God. He comes back around to examine and to investigate and to look under the sun at all the things that are going on, all the things that man puts his heart and his mind, his wealth, his energy to do, and says, 99% of it is striving after the wind, but he comes right back to say, but how does God fit into this? And that's what I'm trying to say for myself, how much I appreciate it. I get all this. I know all this. I know all the wisdom. But how and when I'm in the midst of the same thing do I get to the place and time? And it's, okay, find God in all this. That's what I very much appreciated about what we had here. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24 and 25, just one of the examples of the many places after he said that all things are vanity and all things are striving after the wind, he turns back around and says, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that is from the hand of God. And who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? So here we are, back around. Who can enjoy what you put your hands to do and who can enjoy the fruits of your labor without God? Time and again, he comes back around to say this. He says in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. So there's supposed to be much more to life than what we see under the sun here. There is implications in the consideration of eternity in everything we do. God is eternal. And I see here, it's rather interesting. He puts that dimension in front of us. He says, Solomon keeps bringing back around to us that, remember eternity. God is eternal. God is part of this dimension. He's part of this factor. He's part of what you consider. But he goes on to say, yet he has done this so that man will not find out the work which God has done. Why? We can't see beyond where we are today, for one thing. We can't see God and his master plan beyond what's been revealed to us. We can't see the nature of God with any more than what's been read for us. But trusting what he says here, he's telling us, irrespective, remember eternity, thereby remember God. And by the way, don't think that you're ever going to get all your answers. You're never going to get all the answers to your satisfaction. Time and again, he says this here in this book. In relating his experiences, Solomon shares very valuable counsel. He says, tells to us in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9 through 12, that two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. Okay, good. So it's good to have somebody help you with your work. For if either of them falls, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him falls without having someone lift him up. Great. OSHA would love to have two people there. Furthermore, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one stay warm alone? There's obviously that benefit. And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn. The bottom line is here is there was, in fact, and there is the temptation to think that we can do all things by ourselves. We can't. We need people. The Lord knew this. He gave us the brotherhood. He gives us mates. He created man, and he created all the animals, said nothing's fitting here, so he made a woman. Thankfully, he did. They're a great design. I appreciate it a lot. And the final day, we use this quite a bit to talk about the relationship of man and woman, with the third cord being God himself. Yet again, another reference to that. He tells us how to properly approach God in worship in chapter 5, verse 1. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. So in the first six verses, as I said, he goes through and he tries to grasp the meaning of life, and he makes all sorts of observations. And then the second half, or the second six chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes, he learns or teaches through a series and a mixture of proverbs and narratives, imparting wisdom to make the most of life under the sun as we live it, explaining how among such vanity we should actually live. And there's a wealth of wisdom, obviously, in here, and there's way too much to cover. But I would like for you to help to turn with me to chapter 7. And I'm going to be patient with me. You will. I want to read the first 14 verses of chapter 7. And I'm reading from New American Standard. I know that can be kind of a problem for everybody, but if that is, just listen then. A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house to a house of feasting, because that is the end to every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the songs of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. And this, too, is futility. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger subsides in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection against, just as money is protection, but the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of the possessors. Consider the works of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him. We'll stop there. But this passage comes back around to me to look at, again, the wisdom that Solomon has intends for to pass on for this. He talks about the things that are better. And note how many times he talks about what's better here. That he says a good name is better than precious ointment. The value of a good reputation, that should go without stating to all of us. Precious ointment is basically representative of wealth, and we understand the vanity of wealth as it is. Solomon says back in chapter 2, I think it's rather interesting, back in chapter 2, we won't go there, but Solomon speaking in chapter 2, he says, I've done all these great things. I've built all these magnificent things. I've gardens and roads and kingdoms, and I've gathered all this wealth, and I've gathered all these ponies, and I've done all this great stuff. And he gets done, he says, who knows if in the end I don't give it all to a fool? Now, do you think he might have had some insight into what he was basically getting ready to give his life work to already? The father who writes this to his son? Rehoboam didn't exactly do wisely with what his father left him. In fact, it didn't make it past his generation that the kingdom was divided and it was ruined from that state and time. A man's life's work given to a fool. That's basically what he said. And he tells us time and again here that unless God be in it and give us the ability to enjoy it, that all is for naught. So he talks about a good reputation, and he says a good reputation before God and men has benefit, not only now, but after death. A good name is written in heaven, is it not? That's what our objective should be, to have our name written in heaven. So in this life, it's better to spend time making a good name for ourselves than accumulating wealth, and most of us know that. But it's unusual for us to consider that our death day is better than our birthday. We don't think those terms very often, do we? But that's what Solomon says here. Of course, that assumes one has a good name. The day of our birth is the beginning of many sorrows. We remember that Job, he cursed the day that he was put on the earth. He cursed the day that he was given life. So did Jeremiah. Same thing. Cursed the day that he was given life. Cursed the day that he was born. But we're told time and again that once once we die, once we pass in this world, we go to a place, if we have a good name, of peace and of rest. We go to be with the Lord, according to Paul in Philippians chapter 1. We get to rest from our labors, according to Revelation chapter 14. We're told that a funeral is better than a party. Not usual for us in this day and time to think such ways. I know people that just won't grace the doors of a funeral. They won't go there even to contemplate it. Nonetheless, we realize that the reason that this wise man says this, because he says, for that is the end of all men. Under the sun isn't forever. To go to a funeral is to consider the eternity that God has put into the hearts of all men. You want to run from it, you can run from it, but it's still there. You've got to deal with it. In the course of doing so, one will take to heart the things that he sees and hears about life, and that dimension comes alive to us well again. Sorrow is better than laughter. Laughter does have its place, but sorrow is superior for the heart. Laughter is temporary, but sorrow can lead us and encourage us to make positive, necessary changes in our lives. It's part of what God has put into us. So the wise person will be just as willing to go to a funeral as they're willing to go to a party. Goes on to say that it's better to hear the rebuke of a wise than to hear the songs of fools. And I'm still in the concept in my mind in a funeral. I'm sure there's been hundreds of them here. And somebody gets up here and exhorts the brethren to understand and to think in terms of eternity from this point in time. Better to hear that than the laughter of fools. To hear the fools like crackling thorns under a pot, just popping and making their noise and being done. Sure, they make us feel good for a while, but certainly not to the eternal degree that other changes and reforms make in our lives. The end of a matter is better than the beginning. We've already seen that a person's death day is better than their birthday, but this is applicable to all things in life. What it's saying here, basically, and we heard Solomon say it time and again, is the conclusion of the matter. To get to the place where we see the conclusion of the matter, we start good, and many times we don't complete things very good sometimes. But when we finally finish something, we have a great deal of satisfaction. Many things, they start with grief and difficulty. but they end up with joy and peace. They're very difficult for us to deal with, and in the end, the results are very satisfying. Our primary concern should not be how things start out, but how they turn out. And that's what we should spend our time trying to ensure. Patience is better than pride. We won't spend tons of time on that. That's an obvious. But to consider that the present is better than the past. Again, why does he say that? The good old days. We all long for the good old days. We look back and remember the good old days. We bemoan the good old days. Things were better back then. In my own experience, all I could do for so many years is wait for the next opportunity to do something better than where I was at. Now I look back at the good old days. You know, the problem is the human mind forgets the bad. It just does. The human mind forgets why we didn't want to stay where we were in the good old days. We've all wanted to look for changes in our lives. Many of us have got there, and finally we wake up, we look up, and we see the psalm was absolutely right. It's all vanity and striving after wind. I wish I would have been happier back then. I'd have been happier for all those years. And now I find myself here and I got to where I really never thought I'd get. And I look back and I wish I'd go back there and let somebody else make all these hard decisions all the time. And lose their sleep. And lose their hair. And all the stuff that goes along with it. It's just part of life. We forget how that is. It says, goes on to say, wisdom is better than wealth. I don't think we need to spend tons of time on that. In the final day, wealth, like wisdom, can be a defense in life, but riches have no profit in the day of wrath, we're told here. Wealth often makes things worse. Wealth ruins marriages. Wealth is, or the lack of these things. Obviously, everybody seems to be happy, but we end up fighting over money. Lots of businesses and business ventures start out well that die because of how the money split. Wisdom gives life to those who have it, how we use the wealth, how to use wealth to help weather storms. But then finally, I think that the thing that I really appreciate about this passage that we've read is in the verses 13 and 14 where it says here, basically, resignation is better than indignation. What's he really saying here? There's some things we just can't change. God has his purpose. God has his purpose for life, and he allows both good and bad. He allows prosperity. He allows poverty. He allows adversity. There is an appropriate time for everything under the sun. And in the final day, what God makes crooked, we aren't going to straighten out. We can try, but we'll usually break it. If God made it crooked, it probably isn't going to get straight. So, why are things like they are? I don't know sometimes. God does. And if God made it that way, it's mine to endure. So what's the conclusion at least of what we've read so far? Because I want to finish up with another thought. The preachers taught us to honor that honor is better than luxury. Death day is better than your birthday. A funeral is better than a party. End is better than the beginning. Patience better than pride. Presence better than the past. Wisdom is better than wealth. And resignation is better than indignation. Well, the first thing I'd like to say, if any of this sounds foreign to our thinking, then we should probably be alarmed. We have forgotten eternity. We have forgotten what God has given us to think about with regard to this life. But these teachings are from a wise man, and absolutely the wisest man ever placed on the face of the earth, who, in my estimation, nearly went to madness, to the edge of madness, learning these lessons. I really honestly believe that he could have nearly gone mad trying to get out of these had God not saved him. He experienced everything that life had to offer under the sun. And he offers counsel from a perspective of wisdom and inspiration here, counsel that I think is completely consistent with other principles in either testament pertaining to matters under the sun. What I see here in the book of Ecclesiastes is two things. I see the lessons for us is to pursue all things from a spiritual and an eternal perspective. Makes perfectly good sense. But then to persevere in the face of what looks to be futile, looking for the connection to God in that plan. And I think that's, to me, is a major key here. Solomon's honest enough to share with us all the lurid details of what he had experienced. But he went on to be wise enough to help us on our journey so we didn't have to step in the same piles that he did. It's essentially what we should appreciate about what Solomon did as he went through this. He had face time with God, literally had face time with God, knew God existed, knew that God was, gave him this beautiful gift of wisdom from above. And he goes off to nearly squander it to the point of ruining himself. And we know that he left lots of things a mess still. We did. I mean, I'm not going to make any excuses for him. Messed up a lot of stuff. In the final day, however, he came back around to tell us God. And if we miss his conclusions, if we miss the entire purpose of this writing, it lost all of its value. Nothing good comes from it at all. He comes back around to help us with God. So I'm going to take it to us now. I want to just say that I think as I contemplate this, as I think about this, if I thought about how to apply it, I said how this time it was different for me. I got to thinking about how Jesus intends the very same thing for us today. The very same process for us today. In his Sermon on the Mount, he's motivating us essentially to perseverance beyond where we are. Perseverance being the key, I think, is what I learned from Solomon that I probably didn't pick up on before. I know all these things are right, but how do you get there? It's a mind, it's processing of the mind. And Jesus, in Matthew chapter 7, verse 7 and 8, it's a very familiar passage. Ask and it shall be given to you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receive. And he who seeks, finds. And to him who knocks, it shall be opened. It sounds like Solomon saying, I've given my life to go search all these things. And Jesus said, search it out. Find God in it. Look for him. You're going to be in the same futile world under the sun that everybody has been before you. And go knock, seek, knock, and find. There's a progression here. Asking is one level, but then seeking, that's stepping out beyond. I ask the good Lord to help me find it, and then I look for what his answer is. I look for the conclusions he wants me to find from it. And then finally, I knock. Once I think I've found what it is that God wants me to enter into and go through, I knock. And I keep knocking. And when my right hand gets bloody knuckled, I knock with the left hand until it's bloody knuckled. And then I knock with my knees and I knock with my head if I have to, but I keep knocking. And it's that persistence that I think that God is looking for in our lives. When it looks futile, when we're knocking and knocking and knocking, keep knocking. That's what I really think that I'm looking at here. Jesus, when he came to this earth, he wasn't bound. He taught us, unlike any of us have probably appreciation for, he wasn't bound to anything under the sun. He didn't get tied down with any of it. He wasn't of under the sun, was he? Jesus had no interest in those things. But he sure was interested. It was sure interesting to me how every time he would talk about something that was valuable in heaven, it was related to something that was valuable under the sun. You ever notice that? Every time he would teach his followers, his disciples, he said the kingdom of heaven was like great pearls or like a treasure found in a field. And we go, oh, wow, that is pretty good. Because those are under-the-sun pursuits, right? And if we find them, we think we've really gotten something. When he speaks about the souls of the world, he talks about a great harvest or a great catch. You go, wow, that's worth going after. That's what God was teaching us, or Jesus was teaching his disciples when he taught these things. So these were values that we saw, and he could relate us to it, but he never actually had any desire to find great pearls or great treasure or great harvest or great catch besides the souls of men and the heavenly pursuits. So those whom he called, his apostles, came after him. Again, men that had very little, shall we say, adherence to this world or to the things of this world. They had the one calling was to establish the church and to set forth the truths that we would all live by. And that from that standpoint, they were men that were not committed to things under the sun, and they weren't bound here, if you will. So I ask you, how did that turn out for them, for Jesus and for his apostles? What was our great reward? I mean, remember at one point in time, the disciples were saying, what's in this for us? You remember? What's in this for us? I mean, I got to live under the sun. Jesus told them, you're going to have rewards that you won't even recognize, which you'll never even be able to use it all, enjoy it all. And he was right. But really what it comes down to, whether we're asking ourselves under the sun or above in the heavens, is the two things. What was in it for them? From an earthly standpoint, what was in it for them was suffering and excruciating pain and cruel treatment, all of them. But above in heaven, where are they today? These apostles, for a few short years, and you're saying it's easy for you to say, but in the realm of all eternity, for a few short years, these men dealt with this, and for eternity, they're sitting in thrones in the throne room of God. Imagine that. A few short years of pain and suffering and sacrifice to sit in the throne room with God. I'll be happy just to have a refrigerator box in the alley. That's an amazing thing to me. What about us? A little bit different proposition. We haven't been called to do what the apostles did. We haven't been called to do that. We haven't been called to do what Jesus did. What have we been called to do? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 9 through 12. Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed you do practice it towards all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more and to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands just as he commanded you, so that you may behave properly towards outsiders and do not be in any need. So unlike the apostles, we're to put down roots. We're to do things differently. And we're to settle in for the long haul. And we're to demonstrate how to live a good life before God in the midst of where he's put us right here. Love the brethren, lead a quiet life, mind your own business, keep your head down and be productive. And looking for and finding God in the midst of it all. You know, I got to tell you, I'm very comfortable with those instructions. I lean on that a lot. I really do like that. I can go to work, I can come home, I can keep my yard up, wash my car, keep the leaves out of the neighbor's gutters. I just do these kind of things, and I just mind my own business over here, and I just stay quietly in my own little cocoon. Everything's cool, right? I lean on that. I like that. The problem is, that comes with its own set of challenges and temptations, does it not? Does it not make it easier for us to again, pull ourselves in and to assimilate what's going on in the world around us and to lose our unique identity? Ed had in his prayer, it caught my ear, salt and light. I can pull into my cocoon and my salt and light can stay right in there with me. We are called to do something different. And the reason that I think it's so interesting here is that we can settle in and be amiable to our surroundings and we can do exactly what this passage tells us to do. And in the final day, we can lose all of our effectiveness. We can lose every bit of it. You know, when I was young, I had no appreciation for the concept of perseverance. When I was young, I thought perseverance was something that I maintained back in my back pockets in case the day came when I was persecuted. That's when perseverance was required. Because I was young and I was in the track and I was going to run from here to there. And by the way, I lived in a country that let us worship our God without fear of persecution. The nation was 85-95% Christian. There was no way this country was ever going to make it hard for me to follow after my faith. Does that feel that way today? 35 years later, not only that, I'm older, maybe a little wiser now, and I see the world for what it is, more like Solomon did. Unfortunately, I wish that I was still as naive, but I do. Probably always been this way, but I'm telling you, the things I see in the TV and I think going on around us, could be a different world for us, even in everybody's lifetime in this room, that's for sure. And that final day, perseverance becomes an essential antidote for the psychological warfare that's less obvious than outright persecution, but it's also has the potential to affect our spiritual effectiveness. It does. It makes us want to pull in and stay away more and more. from what's going on around us. Again, when I was younger, I only focused on the start of the race. I was in the military, and I remember having to go on long runs. And I remember I was so young. I was 17 years old when I went military. I got out before I was 21 years old. And I remember being just stupid enough to think that I could get out there and just run as fast as I could. And at the end of that 5 miles, I was going to be running as fast as I left. Right? I knew from here to there how to get there. Settle into a good rhythm. I'm going to beat them all. It's so ludicrous. While that strategy isn't flawed in principle, it certainly is in reality. You know, ask any runner, and they'll tell you that there's a great deal of difference between hoping to run well and actually training and being able to run well. That's the difference between what we see here. To me, we have when the scriptures talk about us running a race, as being analogous or metaphorical speaking towards with regard to the life that we have, it's a perfect one. And we know it is because they use it in the scriptures, right? What does he say? He says, what does he do? He said in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 through 3, lay aside the encumbrances and the sins so easily entangle you. Set that aside. Don't kick any baggage. He goes on to tell us to fix your eyes on Jesus, who himself endured hostility by sinners, who endured the cross, despising the shame. Remember, consider Jesus. That's all eternity, keeping eternity in our minds. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, and I'm not going to read it all. You know this passage. Run in such a way that you can win. Run with self-control, that is, with discipline. And this is what I was making the point earlier about how I appreciate. Yeah, I know about this self-control thing, but how do I get the mind right? I mean, I know it's one thing. I can duct tape myself to a chair. Is that really self-control? Self-control is getting your mind right to where you can process this thing and get some results out of it, some true results out of it. And that's where I had such a great insight for the third or fourth time around in Ecclesiastes. Starting the race doesn't guarantee finishing the race. And starting on track doesn't guarantee finding the finish line. That's truth. That's the truth for all of us. It's our job helping one another to get there. That's why we recall what we've read in 1 Thessalonians about what we do, love for the brethren, the things we do. You know, metaphorically speaking, I'm in that stretch of the race. And I'm in the company of people that I should be ashamed to say this, but statistically speaking, I'm about the 18-mile mark. Okay? I'm about to hit the wall. Okay? I've been long enough here to see the things like Solomon, and I look what's going on around me. And I see those things going on around me, and it wants me to just do what Jonah did. I know God wants me to go out there and evangelize and do these things and do the right thing with his people that don't care about God anymore. And you know what? I just want to turn tail and go the other way. I just want to run the other way and find a quiet place and just do out my days. I want to do 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. That's what I want to do. You hit the wall. So in the final day where I'm at in my place, I'm tired and the prospects of feeling any better than I do right now are unlikely. But in the final day, in spite of it all, I get the courage and the encouragement from what I see in Solomon to say, find God in all this. Keep eternity on your mind. And I think that's a great thing. Because one thing the great preacher Solomon told us in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, I won't read it, but you all heard it before. It's just going to get worse. My eyes are going to get dimmer. My ears are going to get duller. My strength's going to get weaker. The capperberry isn't going to work anymore. Whatever that does, I'm going to be sad that doesn't work anymore. I have an idea, by the way, but I won't use it in mixed company. Anyway, I think you see the picture. We're just going to get frailer. We're just going to want to come in and close ourselves in more. In the final day, the one who fights with us and for us is bigger than anyone who fights for this world. And we can lose our sight on that so easily and so quickly collapse in on it. So, what am I to do? Shed the encumbrances and the sin that so easily besets. Focus on Jesus. Run with focus. Run to win. Exercise that self-control. And with focus and discipline, remember that the race isn't even finished when I hit the finish line. Just starting. Easy, right? Easy. Am I the only one who didn't know that? Probably. But a couple of passages. I want to just make these points as we're very much close to wrapping up. I'm sorry if I've gone over. I have no idea. Revelations chapter 13 and 14 both have a passage that I find very, very interesting. An angel speaking to John in two places makes this point. In Revelation 13 and 10, it says, if anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance in the faith of the saints. And the next passage, in the next chapter, in chapter 14, verse 12, it says, here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God in their faith in Jesus. In the middle of that book, the exhortation comes time and again. Go back to 13. I'm just going to say in chapter 13, it's basically saying, God wants you to go to captivity you go. You pick up the sword, you want to fight by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. The point is, you're going to make a decision at some point in time to persevere in your faith and your belief in Jesus Christ. You can go either way. You can choose to live under the sun, or you can soon live above the heavens. Make your decision. But in the final day, what he's saying here, the perseverance of the saints is to keep the commandments of God and the faith in Jesus. That's how we persevere. That's how we survive. In the midst of the revelation, the exhortation is the same. Whatever God calls us to endure, we need to endure. This being the perseverance of the saints. I'm not sure that we'll ever experience anything like what that cloud of witnesses that we've read so much about in Revelation have. I don't know. I have my children back there. I hope not. In the flesh, my first response is to say, I hope not. But again, if it ever happens, by the grace of God, I hope we all have the strength to endure it. It's such a small thing compared to what denying it would mean, would it not? So, we need to understand and apply our perseverance today, that our attitudes are right, our strength is right, we're fortified in our beings, so we're ready to face what's before us. The whole conclusion is, Solomon would say, fear God and keep his commandments. By the grace of God, he was able to figure that out without having the rest of the testaments and Jesus Christ to stand for him. That's pretty amazing to me. I've been pretty rough on Solomon in times past, and I still don't get some of the things. I'll maybe in the next 3 years go around and I teach it again. I'll get it that time. I thank you for your time. I don't know if anyone here is subject to imitation of Jesus Christ, but I will say, I hope that if any of us have lost our way, have gotten to that place where our discouragement has caused us to maybe not stand and walk for Jesus as we should, that opportunity is ours to confess that as well. But if anybody's subject to the great gift, believe me, if the world can keep us from recognizing what Jesus Christ has done for us to save us from this world and to take us onto eternity, if the world can keep us there, it certainly has done its job. I thank you for the opportunity to stand with you and to sing with you and to speak with you, and look forward to getting to know you all better if I don't. Let's stand and sing. The song's been prepared for us, and this opportunity is ours to render obedience to the gospel.